Welcome to Dispatches, the official podcast for the Journal of the American Revolution. The Journal of the American Revolution publishes weekly online at www.allthingsliberty.com. For the latest in research, reviews, and commentaries, America's most important history is available free of charge at the Journal of the American Revolution.
And this was a series of events. This was not a thing. You had to do one, then the other. And then the last part of his orders, which is what sort of got him in trouble, was a little bit of discretion.
That's author and Journal of the American Revolution contributor Eric Sterner discussing Essex Hopkins and the raid on Nassau. And he's our guest today. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Dispatches. This episode is brought to you by the Sons of the American Revolution. Begin your revolutionary journey here. Visit sar.org. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Dispatches. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. Today, our guest is Journal of the American Revolution contributor and author Eric Sterner, and he'll be discussing the raid on Nassau, led by Essex Hopkins. Anytime Eric Sterner has a chance to come on the show, I'm very excited to welcome him as a guest. As an author of several books, he really offers this great insight into a lot of the moving pieces of the revolution that don't often get talked about enough. He works a lot in the American Revolution and the Western theater in his work, and it's been tremendous. And here we have this sometimes maligned, mostly unknown, naval raid into the Bahamas. And I can't think of anyone better than Eric Sterner to take this on. He's written a phenomenal article. Of course, as always, you can read it at www.allthingsliberty.com. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our interview with Eric Sterner. Eric Sterner, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Eric, you've been on many times before. Remind us about your background.
Well, professionally, educationally, I've got a background in political science with a focus in international relations and area studies. So I'm not a professional historian. I spent my career in sort of national security and aerospace, worked in Congress, then for the Defense Department and NASA. When I wasn't doing the government service, worked for a series of defense contractors and think tanks, mainly doing policy analysis. And I've been studying and writing about the American Revolution for almost a decade here.
What first drew your interest into this topic?
It's weird. The second piece that I did for the Journal was a profile of John Peck Rathbun, who was a Continental Navy captain. One of the things that he participated in was this raid on Nassau, and it kind of stuck in my mind because I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't even aware of it until I started working on that piece. And so I always wanted to come back to it at some point in little bits and pieces. And I think last year we talked about the fight with the Glasgow British Royal Navy warship on the way back from the raid. And I always wanted to come back to the censure of Essex Hopkins, the Commodore, the first Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Navy, because it seems such a weird thing. It'd been a successful raid, and here he is being censured by Congress for it.
Who was Essex Hopkins?
So Essex Hopkins was the first Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Navy. He was essentially the counterpart to George Washington. He was a Rhode Islander. He was a sea captain and a farmer when he wasn't at sea. He'd been a merchant. He'd been a privateer in the French and Indian War. And he had the ignominy of captaining a slave ship. So he had done everything that a New England naval captain could do. He was a local politician. He'd served in the legislature in Rhode Island. And at the beginning of the war, he was appointed brigadier commanding all Rhode Island military forces. So that came around October 75. His brother Stephen served in the Continental Congress and used his influence, I guess. Hopkins was appointed Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Navy in December 75. So here he is, Commander-in-Chief, and they handed this brand-new fleet and sent off on his first mission.
Eric, what was the nature of Hopkins' orders from Congress?
Well, Congress delegated the authority for dealing with the Navy to the Naval Committee. And the Naval Committee actually issued his orders in January 76. And there were four parts to it. First is he was to go to the Virginia Capes. The Navy was based in Philadelphia, and he was to go down to the Virginia Capes at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. And if, quote, not greatly outmatched, essentially cleared of British forces. We're all familiar with Governor Dunmore, who was running riot through the Chesapeake Bay with a bunch of small craft. The Royal Navy had put in its appearance off the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay and just off Norfolk. And the Virginians wanted him out. He was really cramping their coastal trade. He was a constant threat up through the Chesapeake Bay to both Maryland and Virginia. So it was a real problem for them and their security and their ability to continue functioning economically. So Congress, in the form of the Naval Committee, ordered him to go down there and clear it out, get rid of the British. Then he was to go do the same thing in the Carolinas. The main focus for that was Charleston. But, you know, North Carolina and Wilmington had some issues with British ships just offshore. And then he was to proceed up to Rhode Island and do it again. So he finally got to go home here on the third part of his orders. And this was a series of events. This was not a Chinese menu. He had to do one, then the other. And then the last part of his orders, which is what sort of got him in trouble, was a little bit of discretion. And I'll go ahead and read it because it's you can decide for yourself how much discretion is attached to this. Quote, notwithstanding these particular orders, which 'tis hoped you will be able to execute, if bad winds or stormy weather or any other unforeseen accident or disaster disable you to do so, you are then to follow such courses as your best judgment shall suggest to you as most useful to the American cause, and to distress the enemy by all means in your power. And I think the important part about that last little phrase there, that last clause, is even that is conditional. It's not a blanket grant of authority to do with the Navy as he chose, but it's if you're not able to execute your orders because of weather or unforeseen accident or disaster, and arguably none of those things obtained during the cruise of the Continental Navy.
Eric, how does Hopkins interpret these orders?
He focuses on that last part and takes it as a broad grant of discretion. Almost from the start of his command, he disregarded the first three elements of his orders to go to Virginia, the Carolinas, and Rhode Island. So his entire focus is on that discretion, and he gets into this with Jefferson here later after the raid. He decided that the situation in the fleet was sufficient to use that discretion. Okay, so when the Continental Navy descended from Philadelphia down the Delaware Bay, off to the mouth of the Delaware Bay, it was iced in. So it took them a while to get down the bay. They left in January, and it took a while to get down the Delaware River and then down to the mouth of the bay. Most of his crew was sick. I don't know if it's most, but a significant portion of his crew was sick. Smallpox was running in the fleet, and finding sailors was a nightmare for him. So he essentially decided that he needed warm weather for his fleet to function, for the men to recover, and for the ships to sort of get back in condition to operate. So he set the rendezvous in Bahamian waters before he departed Delaware Bay. Essentially, he'd made the decision we're going to the Bahamas before he even left the bay. Whether or not he decided to conduct the raid at that point is debatable. John Paul Jones later recorded And I think others agreed with him or confirmed what he decided or what he learned, that they learned from some naval captains they took, not prisoner, but sort of intercepted in the Bahamas, that there was a store of gunpowder in Nassau. So they decided to go for that rather than carrying out his orders. And this was all Hopkins making this decision. Reading sort of Jefferson's interpretation of Hopkins' orders and the orders, the Hopkins' own defense of his behavior, he really got cold feet about combat. He may have had little confidence in his fleet given the illness among the crew. These were all converted merchant vessels. They were not trained gun crews. He was relatively familiar with British naval practices. He would have had legitimate reason to be intimidated by the British Navy. And you get the sense that he just really did not want to go fight the British, either in Virginia, the Carolinas, or Rhode Island. But the bottom line was, he took that last little grant of authority and discretion and drove a Mack truck through it.
Eric, why was Hopkins criticized for his raid on Nassau?
That's what really stuck with me and why I wanted to come back to the raid and what led to this article. At first glance, this raid was a massive success. He'd invaded another British colony. They had seized 88 cannons. Some of these are substantial guns. 15 mortars, thousands of round shot, and then all the artillery tools, sponges, rammers, and things that go with it. They didn't get much gunpowder because the governor had, you know, very, very surreptitiously and very quickly moved it out of the two forts that defended Nassau Bay. Hopkins had disarmed both those forts, but they didn't seize, they spiked. And he had demonstrated the weakness of British naval power in 1776. If anything, he'd sort of poked a little, let a little air out of that balloon. So perhaps it was something that the Americans needed to be less afraid of than they might have been, and the British needed to have more concern than they would. But again, it comes back to, while that's a great success, it had nothing to do with his orders. Clear the Virginia Capes, clear the Carolina coasts, and then head up and do the same thing in Rhode Island. So you're ordered to do one thing, did something completely different. Something completely different may have been successful, but it wasn't what Congress had wanted him to do.
Eric, you write about why Thomas Jefferson, a Southerner, finds this raid distasteful, yet John Adams, a Northerner, has no problem with it. Could you talk about that sectional divide?
Yeah, and this is I think, again, part of what was interesting here is Jefferson later on sort of recorded as best he could in a long note to himself the criticism that had been made of Hopkins in Congress and Hopkins' defense of himself in Congress. And Jefferson, being a pretty good lawyer, took apart each little argument. And I think what that gets us to is this view in Congress or in the Naval Committee. They had an overarching sort of strategic concept, a strategic plan, a strategy, for lack of a better way to put it, for the fleet. Okay, they wanted to deal with Dunmore's little flotilla in Virginia and clear the coasts. That was critical to the Naval Committee. And as far as Jefferson was concerned, it had been the rationale for the Navy. Okay, and that's he actually wrote that down. That's why we incurred this great expense. So from his standpoint, you know, even if you've been operationally successful strategically, you've failed miserably. Now, Adams took a lawyer's a view of it, and he accepted at face value each of Hopkins' reasons or rationale for not pursuing his mission that he'd been assigned. So sort of Jefferson was like, you failed to implement the strategy, and the strategy is why we built the fleet. Adams was like, circumstances conspired so that you couldn't take it out. So he's more inclined to accept Hopkins' arguments he's also a little more charitable in terms of the poor intelligence that Hopkins had about what was going on in the British Navy. And I think this goes to sort of Hopkins' cold feet about combat. The British Navy in the South was not as strong as Hopkins might have feared, but he didn't know that. And due to a storm early in his mission, he'd lost contact with two of his faster ships, which he might have used to go in and collect intelligence at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. So, again, it's more of a Jefferson arguing you've lost the plot here, and Adams saying you had good reason to do what you did.
What was Congress's ultimate decision regarding this raid?
They censured him. The strategic failure was clearly a problem for the South. There was no getting around it. I think things were made worse by the fact that when Hopkins returned to New England, ended up in Connecticut after the fight with the Glasgow, he started dispersing the cannon. Actually, he'd started issuing orders to disperse the cannon that he'd seized while he was in the Bahamas. And those cannon were not bound for the South. He was intimately familiar with the defense needs of the coasts in New England, having commanded all military forces in Rhode Island for a few months. He was, of course, a New Englander. So he started writing governors, you know, do you need this? Do you need, I've got some guns here. Do you need these guns? And they were naturally willing to take him up on it. So I think that also undermines sort of his position with Congress. The way Congress dealt with him was they initially created an ad hoc committee just to look at his compliance with his orders. And it wasn't necessarily a committee that was set up to punish him or censure him. It was more of a committee to deal with some questions raised, I assume, by Southerners about his compliance with his orders and whether or not everybody had been on the same page from the get-go. That responsibility got moved around several places. The committee eventually concluded that he had not complied, and they referred their report to the Congress. Hopkins asked to be heard. He was heard in Congress. They debated the issue and then voted a resolution of censure. So he did not lose his command over it. He was not punished in any way over it. It was just sort of a congressional expression of dissatisfaction. And as Adams points out, it was a 6-3-3 vote. So six states at this point wanted to censure him. Three, and I assume these are the New England states, in particular Rhode Island, Connecticut, and perhaps Massachusetts, given Adams' influence, didn't want to censure him. And then three delegations were split. So that's it. He was censured. But he did not go back to sea in any major capacity as commander of the fleet. So I think the censure was sufficient enough to express no confidence in him.
Eric, you say in this article that this is the beginning of Hopkins' downfall. Could you talk about why?
Sure. He, of course, he was a New Englander, and we're all, I think, familiar with the sectional disagreements and differences going on in the Continental Congress at this point. It was a natural thing. You were going to get, if you wanted a sea captain to be in charge of your Navy, you were going to get somebody from New England that had the seafaring tradition. So he was kind of an outsider for the southern colonies and arguably for some of the mid-Atlantic colonies, Virginia and Maryland, who had to deal with Dunmore. The Navy itself, the creation of the Navy, was kind of controversial. It required an immense amount of resources. Getting it built was sort of an ad hoc affair. It was a series of compromises. You see this in the sending of various ship assignments. You know, you guys go build two frigates. These two states are going to build two frigates. This state's going to build a frigate. And that reeks the political compromise. The South felt that it was suffering the most, because it lacked significant state navies, understandable given its lack of a seafaring tradition. It didn't have privateers the way that they had taken off in the North. I mean, George Washington had, as of course we were familiar with, built his own little navy. And the port defenses in the South were incredibly weak. Given the resources poured into the Navy, there were very high expectations for the Navy, and then Hopkins had failed to deliver. Not only had he failed to deliver, he hadn't even tried to pursue the strategy it was agreed upon. So there could only be dissatisfaction among those southern colonies with him. Then you toss in the issue of the cannon that were seized during the raid and how those were dispersed. He wouldn't even tell George Washington what he had. George Washington had to met with him to try and get a handle on what Hopkins had seized, and Hopkins wouldn't tell him, or apparently didn't tell him. He instead had to go get the information from Congress, and Washington actually had to ask Congress to tell Hopkins to tell me what he's got. There was major personnel disruption and dissatisfaction in the fleet. The fight with the Glasgow didn't go well. There were some court martials within the fleet, lesser captains or lower ranking captains, and their performance in the fleet that did not win Hopkins any friends. The manpower shortages were acute, again, because we've got this illness running through the fleet. He's had to borrow sailors from the Army, so these are landsmen. They don't necessarily know what they're doing. And, of course, Washington wanted them back. So he wasn't making any friends with George Washington. And then, finally, when he was back in New England and Connecticut, he couldn't get the fleet back to sea. I think he gets a raw deal here that it wasn't entirely his fault, given the shortage of personnel, of trained sailors. But it is what it is, and Congress, the southern states in particular, were already dissatisfied with him, so failing to take the fleet back to sea and to complete that mission he'd been assigned did not win him any friends.
Eric, how does this article help us understand the Revolutionary era better?
Well, I think it tries to raise questions that maybe get glossed over, and this is debates over strategy. And this is a real problem for the Continentals. Because in the Army, we're focused on George Washington, and he carried on such a close correspondence and was very attuned to the political needs of keeping Congress in touch and familiar with what he was planning and taking the pulse of the politicians in both Congress and the states. That disagreement, I think, is less visible. It's a real problem for the Navy because once they go to sea, they're really not trading a lot of letters with Continental Congress or governors. So that communication is lacking, and that does lead a little bit to a strategic breakdown. I think it highlights the challenge that what do you do when sort of tactical or operational success really doesn't result in the strategic benefit that you're looking for. I think it highlights the emerging challenges of civil-military relations. Again, I think we lose that a little bit with George Washington because he was so attuned to and so attentive to civil authority. But as I said, it's hard to do that with the Navy. And so we start to see a Continental Congress that is still developing that proper relationship. How do we deal with a unified strategy and a commander's discretion, and how do we deal with this as a political authority versus a military or a naval authority? And I think it's a good reminder that, frankly, we had a Continental Navy. We're all familiar with John Paul Jones, as we should be, but he was by no means the entire Navy. The privateering war has gotten a lot of attention lately. But there's the whole Navy out there, and it was engaged in missions and combat. And I like to remind folks that it existed, that it engaged in activities, and whether they were completely strategically successful or not, it's still a record in terms of conducting this raid that I think warrants some greater attention and appreciation.
Eric Sterner, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The music played in this episode included works by Kevin MacLeod and the Sturbridge Colonial Militia. Any unauthorized reproduction or use of this podcast without the express written permission of the Journal of the American Revolution is strictly prohibited. For everyone here at Dispatches, I'm Brady Kreitzer saying so long.